listening to the Happy Market Research Podcast. I'm Jamin Brazil, your host. Natasha Hertzog is the VP of Consumer Insights at Warner Brothers Discovery. Prior to joining Warner Bros. Discovery, Natasha was at Microsoft as head of Global Consumer Insights and Research and head of Category and Consumer Insights for the UK and Ireland division at General Mills. Warner Brothers Discovery is an American multinational mass media and entertainment conglomerate headquartered in New York City. It was formed after the spinoff of Warner Media by AT&T and its merger with Discovery, Inc. on April 8th, 2022. Natasha, welcome to the Happy Market Research Podcast today.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
How did I do on the intro?
Fabulously.
Okay, great. Well, let's start with our contextual question. What did your parents do, and how did that inform what you do today?
When I was thinking about my response to the question, I thought, my God, this is just going to like mark me as the ultimate stereotype of the child that follows in the parents' footsteps. So my dad is a retired psychology professor, and my mother was a clinical therapist and social worker. So I was definitely raised in a family where understanding humans, feeling passionate about people and trying to sort of get under the skin of why people behaved the way they did and what drove people to think the way they did. And, you know, that kind of fascination with human behavior and human motivations, a core part of my upbringing. So didn't go down the shrink route, but I feel like market research is inherently about that human curiosity and trying to understand people at a deeper level. I really do believe my parents fostered that.
It's shrink at scale.
Shrink at scale. Shrink for corporate purposes.
And it's a funny pun.
That sounds like a t-shirt slogan or something.
I know. Yeah. Well, you and I'll just TM that right away. So you recently spoke at Qual 360. By the way, I am such an advocate of this conference.
I love it.
Yeah, it's so good. You spoke about a segmentation study, which you recently released for Warner Media. Now, of course, you couldn't, you know, actually talk about the specific personas, et cetera, it's more about the methodology that you used to achieve the outcomes, achieve the segments. But so having come out of that process, what role do you see qualitative research playing in research like this?
I mean, this was a two-year initiative with so much learning at the back end about what we did right. But, you know, I think what I was hoping people gleaned from that presentation was there were things we could have done better. And I sometimes think that's what makes you a richer researcher. And I mean, intellectually richer, or, you know, but you come out of it with more experience about how you would improve the process moving forward. And the key thing that I think, you know, my team and I learned was that not starting with qual can sometimes lead to blind spots. And I think the biggest blind spot we had was that we were thinking too narrowly about the variables that defined the segments. And that really tripped us up, I think, along the journey. Not to say we didn't build a rich segmentation and that the segmentation didn't have utility as a standalone framework, but what we were missing was a richer and deeper range of characteristics that defined the segments that enabled us to make the connection to the first party data. And that was really the critical piece that we needed to deliver on, because if you don't connect to segmentation to first party data, you can't really activate it, especially at a company that has a direct to consumer offering. That just becomes a basic hygiene piece with the segmentation.
It's an interesting observation. Like, I think traditionally, you know, in research, we would start with qual. I'm thinking this goes back into like the 90s for me. And then it feels like we've moved as an industry, we've kind of moved away from that. Mm-hmm. and really starting with right into the quant phase. You know, I'm talking about like capstone research like this, not just like, you know, whatever thing you're going to do on SurveyMonkey, but it does feel like we've, as an industry, stepped away from qualitative research. And oftentimes we actually wind up seeing it more on the backside of projects.
Yeah. And for segmentations, that's historically been the approach, right? You get this massive questionnaire that asks everything that you can think of about, you know, different behaviors, different motivations, different attitudes, different perceptions. And it's this kind of undisciplined dump of stuff. Now, qualitative research could help actually discipline what you ask. You could cut out probably 30 to 40% of that massive variable dump and have a much tighter, much more disciplined and respondent-friendly questionnaire from the inception. But the idea was you put everything in there so you have all the variables, and then you, you know, effectively look at how those variables cluster, and that's how you create your segments. Then you're like, we have segment A, B, C, D. Now let's do qual and really flesh out who these people are. You know, let's get the depth and the understanding now that we've built the segments. And I think what we figured out is, sure, you know, you probably do want to still go down that path of building up personas. But if you do that kind of depth qualitative research at the inception, you just build a better questionnaire. And I agree that discipline sometimes slips, and it is seen as more of a post hoc exercise rather than something that can actually, feed into the way you even conceptualize it and build out the questionnaire that formulates the segments as a starting point.
So interesting. I'm doing a, you know, speaking of like methodological kind of implications of, or how we actually, you know, structure our methodologies in order to address the research objectives. I'm doing a project right now. So it used to be the case that we would soft launch projects. Mm-hmm. This goes back, you know, really kind of early internet, pre-internet days, because it was so expensive, right? Yeah. Both in terms of time and money. So if you screwed up something, then in the survey or what have you, then, you know, there'd be a problem. So we would do in some test markets, you know, a 10% completion rate, get that data back, analyze it, make sure it made sense, and then do a full launch after that. And it's interesting how, like, so in this, for the first time, I want to say in probably five, maybe even a decade, I had a client that said, what if we do a soft launch and see how the project goes? And I'm like, wow, that's so great. What an interesting idea. So it is, I think it's fascinating how we are seeing this resurgence for kind of back to where we started from a research methodology perspective. And I think having qual on the front end, to your point, can do a lot in terms of shaping the actual like survey instrument that we create, which has, you know, two benefits. One is it creates a better participant experience, right? Yeah. By removing your length of survey. But on top of it, it also removes distraction in what you need to be. So you're paying attention to the right things as an analyst.
Well, and then you think about, like, I mean, we probably had 4 to 5 times the number of segmentation solutions than we needed. So then in the back end, we had to kind of go and, in effect, screen out or kind of make executive decisions about which segmentation looks like the best solution or the most viable solution, because some of them were just nonsense. It was just how the numbers fell out. And I think if we had a tighter instrument going into it, we wouldn't have had a bunch of redundant segmentation solutions that we had to sift through. And when you were describing the soft launch thing, it made me think about, you know, the old, like, it kind of brought to mind that old slogan, everything old is new again, which I think applies to everything from fashion to research. But, you know, sometimes those old approaches that you ditched turned out to be the best approach, but somehow, you know, we kind of get locked into these paths of doing things. And somehow that feels like if it's net new, it's an improvement. And sometimes it's just not.
I am 52 years old now and am personalizing that in a positive way.
Oh, that makes us twins then. Yeah. So we are operating from the same lofty vantage point.
Well, let's shift gears a little bit. You have been doing this for a while, like myself. Mm-hmm. You've seen the implications of the impact the internet has had on our industry. You've seen mobile, right? That was also pretty disruptive. The rise of social media has been super interesting, and the ability for us to be able to add in secondary data, whether it's our own secondary data or, you know, externally, you know, into our primary data sets for richer analysis. That's been super interesting. And now we've got rise of AI, like applied AI, OpenAI, which, you know, is a ChatGPT platform. They recently did a webinar. All they did was tweet on it, and there was an email. Like the day that they were going to do the webinar, they had over 100,000 people that joined the webinar.
My God.
I know. It's unprecedented.
That's phenomenal.
It is. It's unbelievable. Like no marketing, literally no marketing dollars spent. And that was the outcome on the attendance. But anyway, so, you know, we've seen all these things take place. What's keeping you up at night?
Oh, so many things keep me up at night. Honestly, I think what's currently keeping me up at night, and actually this will loop very nicely into the AI discussion, is that my team's remit has just grown further. So our internal research services are now part of my team. And we have a very small team, and we're basically running qualitative and quantitative research services for the organization, in addition to, you know, the thought leadership, in addition to the corporate work. And so we're so lean on the ground. I spend a lot of time worrying about how we staff things and how we make sure that we're delivering to the business, delivering to our stakeholders, doing, you know, brilliant work and being proactive, but making sure that the team isn't burning out. And that, especially with the research services piece, has been really top of mind for me. And, you know, I've started to realize that we do so much manually that computers could do. And I would be the first person to sort of say, like, you know, we need the human touch, and there's stuff that people can do that computers can't do. And I firmly believe that. It makes me think of this Katharine Hepburn, Spencer Tracy movie that I love. And you think I could remember the name of it, but it's basically about this kind of early market research team that's working for the equivalent of NBC. And this guy comes in to kind of run their department, and he wants to replace them all with a computer. And this movie came out like in the 60s. And so they're all horrified, and they're sort of fighting for the human touch and saying a computer can't do what people can do. It's hilarious and totally worth a watch. But, you know, that's kind of been my philosophy. And then, you know, we recently just did a huge study, 3,000 open ends, and my team had to manually read through 3,000 open ends. And you're thinking, if we're already thin on the ground, we don't have a ton of resource, should we really be spending our time reading 3,000 open ends? Or is there a place for AI or some sort of software overlay where computers can do this stuff so we can focus on the implications and the analysis and bring the human touch to the piece that's actually important and, you know, lends itself to the things that human beings can bring to the table and are the things that we should just delegate to computers because computers do that work better than us. So that is very much a big part of what's on my mind right now and real time, some of the stuff that I'm starting to implement for the team. So, you know, we can just take a load off and spend our time doing stuff that I think we're better adapted to doing.
Yeah, the whole like more with less has been the right. Yeah, the Grit Reports kind of, you know, standard. This is what's trending year over year over year. Mm-hmm. And obviously that's not going away. But it especially with economic headwinds that everybody's under right now, like it's never been. I mean, maybe two times in my career it's been like this from a pressure perspective. From a, you know, just and at the same time, the brands require so much more consumer facing information because they've got to make the right steps, or face dire consequences. And the speed by which those, you know, decisions need to be made is just like it's at light speed, which is kind of interesting. So thinking about AI, you're kind of like nodding towards the next question. As you think about the next, let's call it 2023 and 2024, how will our space be different?
You know, I would like to think that we become crisper about how we leverage technology to free up our time to do the thinking piece. Look, qualitative research is really about a human dialogue. And there are a lot of things that a human being can pick up that a computer can't pick up. I don't see a world necessarily where you can have a, you know, chatbot do the job of a moderator. I mean, maybe if it's something that's super rudimentary, you know, that's possible. But I still think that there is something unique that humans can bring to the table that a computer can't substitute. And I'm using the term computer very broadly, you know, as a kind of a, I guess, a shortcut terminology for where you bring in a technology solution versus using human labor. But I do think that, you know, we are still probably far too manual and we still spend too much time doing things that we just don't need to do, whether it's on the data analytics side, where you have people scrubbing data and looking for patterns in the data. I mean, computers can do that. In the same way that when you have 64 mobile diaries, and there's very clearly going to be, you know, patterns in that more open-ended data. I mean, certainly as a human, can we go through it and learn and pick up nuances? Yes. But again, that feels like something a computer can do, where at least the level of altitude we're coming in at is more at the thematic level versus the granular, you know, scrolling through, you know, raw transcript level, you know, scrolling through raw transcripts, which is so labor intensive. So I guess what I'd like to see is a world where we really create that crisp division of labor between what we outsource to technology, but what we continue to really prioritize human beings doing. And I still feel like we sometimes tilt too far in the direction of leaning on technology and thinking technology can do it, and get kind of excited about the newest, latest, greatest things without really querying whether this is necessary or whether this is the appropriate use case. And I think that's something it would be great for the industry to work together on, is really understanding, you know, where those nuances sit and where we can really free up the time of the people that are doing the work to think about. I think the big missing piece oftentimes is implications for the business and then implementation. Like, how do we take these insights and make sure they land with the business, but then actually become something tangible that course corrects or shifts the direction that the business is moving in and becomes embedded in the day-to-day work that the business is doing. And you can't do all of that if you're, you know, engaged in, you know, reading 3,000 open ends.
Yeah. I mean, it's not always the barrier, right? Is you got to get the day-to-day work done.
Yeah.
Before you can solve the problem of how you automate or bring efficiency into the day-to-day work.
And, you know, I think it's also bewildering because there are so many companies that do AI that it's hard to even know where to start.
Yeah.
And there are so many little nuances that nobody has the time to dig into. So to whatever extent that world can get simplified, so we really understand, you know, what all the different offerings are and what the sort of discrete differences are between the offerings, that would also help. Because sometimes you're just like, oh my God, it's another AI person, and your head sort of explodes.
Yeah, totally. I think, you know, the whole concept of a research tech stack, so like the technologies involved in or subscribed to and used by an organization in order to accomplish consumer insights. And it's not like a job function currently, but it is something that I think companies that are having to get a lot of stuff done, like on the production side, needs to take seriously. I don't know if it's like a fractional person or, you know, a fraction of a person's time, or, you know, how that happens. But like the opportunity for operational efficiencies is just so great now. And the tools are just changing, you know, so much. But you think about this year alone, the last 2 months alone, like we've probably gone through one of the biggest tectonic shifts in terms of what you can do right now for free.
Yeah.
And so and the disruption that's happening in the tool space, it's absolutely remarkable. I do think, to your point, like the way that we solve this problem is by the intentionality of, like, whether it's headcount or consultancy, but I'm a big proponent of like the internal.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I also would love to see, this is like a call to action to some of the industry bodies. I would love to see, you know, some research on research, or to see some of the, because we just don't have time to like experiment with like five different AI companies to distill like who does it best or whatever. Or again, what are those nuances between them? But it would be great to see some of the industry bodies do that research on research to start to understand kind of the division of labor amongst these tech stack companies or these companies offering software solutions, to take the load off of us in the corporate world who just don't have the time for reflection or an experimentation to the extent that we'd like, you know, to have the time for that.
That's super interesting. I mean, kind of the Gartner quadrant map, magic quadrant map, right? It's like, that would be a super interesting resource. There's another gentleman who's been thinking about that, Tim Hawkins from, I can't remember the name of his business offhand, which is embarrassing. But anyway, they're like a AI-enabled research services company. But regardless, I totally agree. I think maybe that's a task for like Insights Association or something.
Yeah. I don't know. Like one of these multiple organizations that, you know, is out there doing, I mean, they're all doing great stuff, but I would love to, like, whatever they could do to kind of simplify the decision-making process at our end would be phenomenal. So I don't know, maybe somebody out there will hear this.
There's a call to action. Send it out into the ether.
Exactly.
My last question, what is your personal motto?
Oh my God. Well, at our ripe age, I have so many. I was actually trying to give this a thought, like which one, you know, obviously, you know, probably helpful to have one that's work related. I guess I have a couple. One is, and this makes me sound super old fashioned, but I really do stand by it. If you're going to do something, don't do it halfway. I mean, I really feel like if you're going to invest the time and energy in engaging with, like, whether it's a study or whether it's building a questionnaire, I guess there's kind of this constant thirst for excellence. So if you're going to tackle it with full passion, with full intellectual curiosity, and give it 100%. And that's something that, you know, I talk to my team about, like, you know, if this is something we feel we can't tackle with 100% of our being, then, you know, maybe it's not the right thing for us to tackle. I guess the other thing, which is maybe a bit more of a that's kind of like aspirational, but my other motto, which is more pragmatic, is just about the importance of perseverance. You know, I think it's just been such a rocky couple of years, but, you know, I guess when you've been on the planet for a while, you realize that things always turn around somehow. There's always a course correction. You know, things recalibrate, things settle down again. And so, you know, when you're going through those rocky periods or those disruptive periods, you have to kind of find that long-term faith that things do settle down and equilibrium kind of manifests again. And that can kind of give you the strength, I think, to ride out some of the challenges, because it can get really challenging and it can be really disheartening at times when, you know, you're seeing cuts and people are getting laid off, but there's always kind of change around the corner again, and change can be a good thing. So those would be my two mottos: excellence and perseverance.
Oh, I love that. Maybe,
more slogans.
Yeah, maybe we'll have Orphan Annie as our theme song.
Yeah, that does sound like the sun will come out tomorrow, but I'll spare you with the breaking into song bit.
Our guest today has been Natasha Horitzuk, VP Consumer Insights, Warner Brothers Discovery. Thank you, Natasha, for joining us.
Thanks a ton. It's been fun reconnecting.
All right, everybody. If you enjoyed this episode as much as I did, please do the things that you're supposed to do. Hit the like, subscribe. And if you tag me on social media with a screenshot of this episode, I will send you a free t-shirt. Have a great rest of your day.